Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness, produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen. It's not uncommon for medical consumers to seek non-traditional therapies to find relief from symptoms and pain. Some practices once thought of as fringe, not medically based in scientific fact, are now being accepted by insurance companies as studies prove these treatments do, in fact, offer benefits. If you're interested in complementary or integrative treatments, how do you know what's safe and what's effective? One reliable source is the National Institutes of Health. The NIH has established a center to evaluate these therapies and inform the general public of their findings, the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health, which studies alternative treatments through rigorous investigation and research.
Joining us is one of the top experts in the field of alternative medicine. Dr. Josephine Briggs is director of the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health at the NIH. Trained as a traditional physician with an MD from Harvard Medical School, residency training in internal medicine and nephrology at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, and a research fellowship in physiology at Yale School of Medicine, she's recognized internationally as an accomplished researcher. Dr. Briggs is here to help us understand what falls under the umbrella term complementary and integrative medicine and how these practices are evaluated.
Welcome to Take Care, Dr. Briggs. We so appreciate your expertise.
Delighted to be with you.
Let's start with the basics. How do you define complementary and integrative medicine?
It's probably good to take on those two terms separately. Complementary health approaches is a term we use for health approaches that didn't come through standard medical research or pharmaceutical research. They're traditional remedies or approaches to health that have grown up through centuries of practice, things that your grandmother might have recommended or health practices that grew up outside the mainstream of medicine. Integrative is a word being used by a variety of practitioners now, and certainly one feature of the style of practice they provide patients is an openness to some of these non-traditional remedies. Another feature of integrative health approaches are particular attention to health and wellness, and a starting point being the patient's own concerns. It's an emphasis on a more holistic approach to healthcare.
How many American adults are using some form of complementary or alternative medicine?
We do a survey each year with the CDC of health practices of Americans. It's done by interviewers who are trained to talk to households, and they survey 20 to 30,000 households across the country and ask people about their health practices. And from that, we derive an estimate that about 40% of Americans use one or other of these approaches to health.
And what do you think is the biggest motivator in people seeking alternative care?
Well, people are partly looking to these practices to promote their own health and wellness, and are also turning to them for symptom management for conditions that they haven't found an answer to. And by far and away, the most common are pain conditions, so back pain, neck pain, arthritis pain, headache. When we ask people, what health condition are you using this approach for, it turns out to be pain. And, of course, pain management is a huge problem. We all know that powerful drugs will, in fact, temporarily reduce pain, all have very important side effects and long-term risks. And so we see in this turning to traditional practices, whether it's chiropractic care or massage or yoga or meditation, we see this as something that's really important to build evidence about because of its potential benefit with tough problems.
How important is it for patients to talk to their healthcare providers about what alternative care they may be using? Because very often mainstream practitioners may look down on the use of either dietary supplements or other practices that they feel are not proven by science, and the patient may feel reluctant for that reason, among others, to share what they're doing with their general practitioner.
So the most important area where people really do need to share with their docs practices are any dietary supplements. There are a number of dietary supplements that can interact with standard pharmaceuticals. In fact, people should tell their doctors all the over-the-counter medications they're using and all the dietary supplements, because all of us physicians worry that these other medications may interact in ways that are deleterious. I don't exactly worry too much about people telling their doctor the details of their yoga classes, but certainly the use of dietary supplements is a very important piece of health information that needs to be part of people's medical record and shared with healthcare providers.
Over the years that you've been doing this at the NIH, do you see a shift in thinking on the part of the medical establishment and also in the general population in accepting that some forms of alternative therapy do have a place in healthcare?
Well, we're pretty proud of the evidence that we have created through studies that we have supported. And we have found that a large study on ginkgo showing that actually it didn't help with dementia has immediate impact on the use of ginkgo. I think the medical profession, and certainly people providing care for pain patients, are really recognizing that the non-pharmacologic approaches, the mind and body approaches, relaxation techniques, meditation, are adding valuable component to the management of pain. It's not a one-size-fits-all. It's not yes or no. It's what is the patient trying to do, and is it helping?
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
Our guest is Dr. Josephine Briggs. She's director of the NIH's National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, and wondering if the medical establishment has shifted over the years from looking down on some of these alternative therapies to maybe being a little more open-minded.
Right. Here at the National Institutes of Health, our job is research. We also do our best to provide good, reliable information to the public, or at least access to the kind of sources. Our website provides summaries of guidelines written for healthcare providers that are helpful in knowing which complementary approaches can contribute to the management of hard-to-manage symptoms like irritable bowel syndrome. So we work hard to help make sure the evidence is good, and we pay attention to what people are actually doing, what practitioners want to know, and whether we've got good scientific methods to get good answers, and try to make sure that our research fills these gaps in things that the public needs to know and healthcare providers need to know.
Earlier you mentioned ginkgo and how your investigations proved that it was not effective. Does it concern you that there are so many unsubstantiated claims about natural herbs, supplements, and practices being marketed, especially on the internet, to people seeking relief from pain or other symptoms? What's your advice to the medical consumer on how to vet information and navigate the world of alternative care?
No, it definitely concerns us that there's a lot of misinformation on the internet. I hope people do discover our website, and we certainly do our job. And if you Google one of these practices and NIH, you're almost certainly going to arrive at the NCCIH information tools about this. We have a set of questions we urge people to ask about websites. One of them is just who's putting it up, and is this a website that is created by somebody selling something, or is this created by a reliable organization? I think the government websites are very careful about this. They're an excellent website run by Mayo Clinic. There's a good website information by several cancer centers. And the National Cancer Institute here at the NIH has some very good resources for people seeking information about cancer. Another good thing for people to ask when they look at web information is, does it seem too good to be true? You know, this old statement, if it seems too good to be true, there's a good chance it is, holds very much in this space. And so that would be another reason for immediate skepticism if the claims seem excessive. We have special concern about three categories of claims for dietary supplements. And responsibility for the safety of dietary supplements is we're the research part of the government, but the FDA is the part of the government that worries about safety issues. And we partner with them in lots of ways on safety issues. But the three categories of dietary supplements where there are claims that are particularly worrisome: dietary supplements for weight loss, dietary supplements for muscle building, and dietary supplements being sold for sexual function. And all three of those categories, there are excessive and poorly founded claims being made and some real safety concerns about some of the products.
What is your advice on how to choose a reliable and credible practitioner of one of these alternative practices?
That's actually a hard question. You know, we are, as the research arm of the government, careful to stay out of the business of who's a good practitioner and who isn't. The complementary practices, a number of them are subject to state licensure, and state medical boards do provide some information about licensure. But I don't have an easy guide in this area. And the same sort of questions about being attentive to what the practitioner tells you, making sure that you're not talking to someone whose claims seem a little excessive is certainly good common sense. We do have a page on our website about the credentialing process, credentialing, licensing, and education that goes into details about this. And certainly, I hope that's a useful resource if someone is considering a complementary health practitioner.
What would you say are the danger signs for when a medical problem is beyond an alternative medical practitioner's capacity to handle? For example, at what point does somebody give up if supplements aren't working or another form of treatment isn't working, and when should they go back to their doctor?
Most of the areas where we've seen evidence develop for the benefits of complementary health practices involve symptom management. And in general, people with infectious conditions, with injuries, are by and large, in fact, not trying complementary practices, but certainly that's good common sense. And of course, one thing about symptom problems like pain is that the person themselves can be a reasonable judge of whether or not it is helping. Now, all of us, every one of us, is subject to the placebo effect. So if you're a strong believer that something's going to help, symptoms get better. And that's why we do blinded tests. That's why we do blinded wine testing. So just because you feel like it's helping does not mean that it would meet rigorous scientific tests. But good common sense about is this helping me is certainly a perfectly reasonable starting point. And the evidence for these approaches is largely in the areas of, will this help with a symptom that is bothering me? And it has to be placed in the context. Some of these remedies are, in fact, gentler and have more modest effects than some of the potent drugs that are available. But they also often will have no serious side effects. So that's part of the balance, is does this help a little, and are there risks? And I hope that the materials we work hard on help people get good answers on both sides, the safety and the possibility of benefit.
Our guest today, Dr. Josephine Briggs, the director of NIH's National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. Thank you so much for joining us for part one of this interview.